New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics. I'm your host, Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes University, and today I'm here to talk about a great new book in economics and management, and this is China and Global Value Chains, published in 2018 by Routledge. I'm here with one of the authors, Seamus Grimes. The book was written also by a second author called Yu Tao Sun. Welcome, Seamus, and please tell us something about your background and also the background of your co-author.
Okay, thank you very much. So my own background is I'm an economic geographer, and for the last 10 years, I've been focusing mainly on China, on technology development in China, and particularly looking at the role of foreign companies in that development, and also looking at how China has become integrated into global value chains, particularly in the technology sectors. And mainly really by the influence of foreign technology companies in China. And my co-author is comes from a slightly different background. He's more in the area of management, but with a strong background in economics. He's in Dalian University in the northern part of China. So we've been collaborating for the last number of years, writing a series of papers about these topics. And the book basically has brought together a number of these papers, elaborated on some of the things.
Well, the topic is not only very interesting, but also very timely. If I can start from basically page one, the first line is, President Trump has raised the intriguing question of bringing the manufacturing of companies like Apple back from China to the US. So this book is about the very, very, very timely debate about whether it is right, it is possible, it is helpful to deal with China adopting a protectionist strategy. And this book is exactly about this, in trying to explain what China gained through its strong involvement in the past 20, 30 years of globalization, and what the rest of the world has gained. And given the current situation, what is possible to do or not to do, what is not possible to do in terms of regulating the current exchange of goods, in particular the global value chains in technological products. So maybe I could ask you, what is the motivation of writing this book, and what is your position on this very, very timely topic?
Well, I think the main motivation for writing the book, really, as I was saying, was to bring together a number of papers published in various journals, and which have developed different aspects of this research area. It is, as you say, a very timely topic, and it is something that many scholars are grappling with, how to actually understand the effects of globalization, in how that is requiring really a new type of methodology really for researching these topics. And it's very interesting, for example, that large organizations like the International Labour Organization, the World Bank, and various other organizations like that are now beginning to focus much more on global value chains. But it's complicated. And previously, most of our research was based on the nation state and on the domestic market. But as globalization has become much more significant in the last number of decades, it's much more important now to actually understand how different regions of the world have become more and more integrated into international markets. And in fact, I was just rereading a book there in the past few days called The New Argonauts, which was published in 2006 by Annalee Saxenian of Stanford University. And in that book, she explains how many migrants from Asia and from other countries have come to Silicon Valley and have been trained in university and other like that, and then had gone back home and connected through their networks various regions, India and China, and Taiwan and Singapore and so on. And that, you know, gradually these sort of value chains began to emerge by the internationalization of economic activity. But trying to actually map out the connections, you know, between the different regions is not straightforward.
Maybe some of our listeners might not be aware of the definition of global value chain, or even if they are, they are not aware of the complexity of a global value chain, in particular in high-tech products. Maybe the simple is a computer, the most complex is the production of an airplane. Maybe tell us something about this to explain about what extent of complexity we are discussing about.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, basically, it goes back to the offshoring of them, particularly by multinational companies, you know, from the more advanced regions of the world, of their production activities. So the offshoring of manufacturing in particular in the ICT sector, which is really what we're focusing on in this book, and that over the last, say, 30 or 40 years, the major global manufacturing companies, in order to try to sort of improve their competitiveness, they began to set up branches in various parts of the world, in particular cities in around the world. And China, of course, was one of the most attractive places because of the low cost of manufacturing initially, but increasingly because of the attractiveness of a very large sort of volume of talent production in those. So the possibility of employing large numbers of engineers in the eastern part of China, particularly urban eastern coastal zones. And this was also very much connected with what happened in Taiwan initially, because the IT sector was initially developed in Taiwan, and of course in neighboring countries like Japan and Korea as well. But that gradually over time, the major technology companies began to sort of offshore more of the production activities from Taiwan and from Korea, from Japan, to mainland China. And what is interesting is how over time, the value chains involved become more sophisticated. So the whole idea of focusing, because of the internationalization of economic activity, it became important for researchers to develop new frameworks which went beyond just the simple domestic market, even though most of the statistical material that's available still continues to be based on the national domestic market. And we're still talking about international trade, and we're still talking about importing and exporting. But the point is that because of this offshoring of manufacturing activity in particular, what has happened is that different tasks have been sort of relocated to different regions of the world, depending on their particular competitiveness. So, for example, in the case of China, most of the assembly activities were located in China. But over time, this is beginning to change, and the actual activities in China are becoming more sophisticated. And one of the key components, of course, of this activity is property. Now, where does the intellectual property come from? And in some of the work that we have researched for this book, we have explained, of course, that much of the intellectual property is coming from outside of China, but that China imports, if you like, many components of different electronic products, and then they are eventually assembled in China, and then they are either exported to the advanced markets of the world or to other countries, or they are increasingly consumed in China. And if you look particularly at the example of the semiconductor sector, this is obviously one of the key component areas of the ICT sector. And China consumes a huge proportion, and perhaps maybe more than 60% of all the global consumption of semiconductors in the world. But what that actually means is that many global companies have operations in China, or they have outsourced some of their activities to other companies in China, and that these semiconductors are sent to China, and they are gradually used in the assembly of electronic products. Now, China is becoming very, very concerned about the fact that its role in the value chain tends to be a subordinate role, tends to be sort of a low value-added role. So therefore, that means that China actually gets much less benefit from the activities than global corporations that really are controlling much of this sector. So in this way, then, China has already, is in more recent years, is, it has developed a program to try to develop its own semiconductor sector. But this is proving quite difficult because of the significant control of intellectual property by some of the key advanced nodes in the ICT sector in the past countries.
But your book, in fact, is exactly also about China struggling to become more self-sufficient in the chain, but also still learning a lot. And so, but actually, I would like now to make a jump, but forgive me for this, because I'm jumping from the first line to the last line. The last line is about, in the conclusion, there is a little mention of Brexit, the decision of Britain on the membership of the European Union. So what you just said, that as an economic geographer, which is very difficult to map the value chains, it is difficult to measure them, it is difficult to handle their complexity. So what's your opinion about the value chains between Europe and Britain and the possibility that the freedom of movement of goods might become more problematic in the future? In this case, we refer predominantly to the automotive sector, for example. But as an economic geographer, what is your opinion about that specific value chains?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the problems with the Brexit situation, but also similarly with the policy coming from Washington as well, is I think it shows a lack of understanding, really, of how international business is actually conducted, how economic activity has become more internationalized in recent years. I mean, one of the problems, of course, that has arisen is that because of globalization, not everybody has benefited to the same extent. And I think that some of the politicians are not as aware that, in fact, some of the countries like, say, in Asia, particularly China, that have benefited in the sense that they have created employment for their people in those countries through by participating in global value chains. But as I was saying earlier on, they haven't actually benefited to any great extent in terms of value added of the types of functions that are being carried out in those in the particular locations, say for example in China. Similarly, in the case of Brexit, it's very much I think politicians looking at their own nation state almost as an isolated state, and not understanding how participation in international economic activity is absolutely essential, and that it's a question of trying to sort of improve the benefits that arise. Now, I mean, this can create problems, particularly for the United States. Different regions of the United States have not benefited to the same extent as others. And the other problem that arises is that if you look at any sort of major city in the United States and look at the role of, say, the ICT sector, for example, you could divide that city into two different groups of people. One would be blue-collar workers, for example. The other might be investors in those companies. And naturally, the investors in the technology companies have been pushing for many years to sort of increase their profitability, to improve the competitiveness. That has resulted in offshoring a lot of activity to China. But the problem, of course, is that in the functioning of that model, the blue-collar workers obviously lose out. And the politicians, of course, never really fully explain to people how the model is working. They obviously pretend to be representing both sides of the city. But the reality is that if you have a globalized model, some people are going to lose out, some regions are going to lose out more than others. And this obviously creates another series of challenges, if you like, for politicians. But I think the fact is that they have to understand the complexity of the value chains and how they actually work, and not sort of continue on thinking in terms of just the domestic economy of their own national state. If that doesn't really make sense.
Well, this is very interesting. So, this is a matter of complexity, but of course, as you said, there is an issue of imbalance and distribution of the benefits and the costs. But your argument in favor, because I suppose you are in favor of continuing this type of, of course, allowing this type of economic interaction between nations. So, but you are in favor because this is providing overall long term at macro level benefits, or you are in favor because it would be impossible to run our world in other ways?
No, I'm in favor of it because I think it's just a realistic model to develop further, and that if you look at it from the point of view of the major global companies, particularly say American companies, they have benefited hugely from being involved in the Chinese market, for example. And obviously, most of those benefits have returned to the United States and have allowed increased investment in research and development, and have allowed universities and sort of technological regions to sort of recreate themselves in new ways. And what's happening now, of course, is that the regions that were involved in it, the assembly, the lower order functions, and in China, for example, that they are increasingly trying to move up the value chain. And that it's very, very interesting to look at the role particularly of the Chinese state in all of this. Because the Chinese state has been much more powerful as an agent in the development of industrial policy than many other countries, partly because it's a huge country, and partly because the market in China is of huge significance to global corporations. And this has become even more significant in the last few years, post-crisis period, because of the lack of growth in the more advanced regions. These corporations see their future in China. China is a country which is expanding, obviously at a much lower rate than it was previously, but it's still creating new cities, new airports, new infrastructure, and it requires quite a lot of the products and the services and particularly the intellectual property that these global corporations control. Now, what I'm very, very interested in is the dialectic, if you like, between what global corporations, who traditionally have had so much control over intellectual property, and have had the freedom of selecting regions all around the world for their own to locate whatever particular tasks they wanted to locate there, but they're now facing increasing pressure from the Chinese state, which in turn has its own objectives and wants to sort of, not only wants, but obviously is under huge pressure itself to try to move out of low value-added functions and try to move up the value chain, because China itself is losing its competitiveness in relation to other regions because of the fact that it's actually labor market, its labor force is actually in decline, and the costs are increasing all the time, particularly in the more urbanized regions of China. And so China is under significant pressure to try to sort of, to try to exploit intellectual property. Now, the problem, as I was mentioning earlier on in relation to, say, for example, an area like semiconductors, is that it takes quite a long time for any particular country to build up the necessary intellectual property to be autonomous. And China wants to be autonomous for many, many different reasons. And if you you will remember the Snowden revelations a few years ago. And since that time, the technology sector, particularly the foreign technology companies in China, have been sort of encountering significant problems in relation to access to the Chinese market. And one of the reasons for this is that China places a huge amount of emphasis on the security of the state. And there's enormous control in China over the technology sector, particularly anything to do with telecommunications, political activity, so the internet companies and so on. And it's fascinating to see how internet companies, Chinese internet companies, have emerged and have become very, very significant players. They are, to some extent, working within a protected market. And meanwhile, the foreign technology companies that had sort of free reign in the Chinese market for maybe 30 years or more are now beginning to face considerable competition and pressure. Now, I mean, if the politicians in the United States and in Britain and so on don't appreciate the nature of how these changes are taking place, they're still going to be using policies that had to do with it.
Yeah, so clearly there are challenges ahead, but I would like to remember when I was living in China 10 years ago, and every time I was back in Europe, it was difficult to explain to my friends and my students in Europe that the success of China was not just because of its dimension and huge manpower of cheap labor. And from your book, it emerged clearly that to participate in global value chains of this complexity, you need to be rather smart and advanced. And by the way, in the meantime, you also learn and improve your abilities. But now you are talking rightly about the issue of the government. So this is a story not only about private corporations, but also about the state involvement. And your book, for example, describes this history from the accession of China to the World Trade Organization. China is still not a proper full member. So how do you see the current debate about accepting a full market economy status to China within this topic of global value chain, and correctly also what you said about the role of the state in handling very carefully, in particular, the technological sectors?
I find that it's a fascinating topic, and it's not easy to be 100% certain exactly what's actually going on in China, because, for example, at the moment, there's enormous enthusiasm in China about artificial intelligence, about new converging technologies, all sorts of new developments and so on. And to some extent, because the Chinese internet companies have expanded very, very significantly and have actually applied the new technology in very, very innovative ways. There is a sort of a dual situation in the country whereby, on the one hand, they're applying new technologies very, very effectively. And for example, the whole idea of the cashless society, for example, is much more developed in China than in other parts of the world. And but on the other hand, though, they're missing on some of the key foundations of key sectors which feed into the ICT sector. For example, if you look at even the chemical industry in China, and you might wonder what connection, because obviously silicon and there are many, many connections in chemical companies and ICT companies in terms of the manufacturing of products. And the problem in China is that some of the building blocks are still only being developed very, very slowly. And I think one of the fascinating questions is, you know, can a country that is really poor in terms of intellectual property in many ways, but is actually very, very successful in applying technology in a very, very dynamic market, and in a market that's almost excluding, I mean, very almost no foreign internet company has been successful in China. And people will explain that in different ways. You know, they will say that the foreign companies don't actually understand China, they don't understand the market. I think there's a lot to be said for that. But I think the question I'm posing is, whether a country can actually, without having the building blocks, the necessary foundations, the key intellectual property, whether it can actually advance by just simply applying technology. Some people will say, many people will argue that it's absolutely essential for China to develop its own economy. And in fact, in the 10 years or so that I've been looking at China and sort of going back and interviewing companies, sometimes the same companies over and over again, it's fascinating to see how foreign companies, how their fortunes have changed over time, and how it's become much more difficult for them. As I said previously, they had a very, very easy time initially because there wasn't any local technology companies. But you now have companies like Huawei, for example, which has now become basically overtaken Ericsson in terms of the market share, global market share, and is earning as much of its revenue outside of China as it is in China. And you've got a number of other companies like that that have been extremely successful. But some people will say that they have been helped by the market situation in China, where the state is still, as you say, as you were saying, it's not really a free market situation. But just actually on that topic, again, one would not you know, it's important not to be at all dogmatic about what's actually happening in China, because more than anything else, the China approach to all of these things is pragmatism. They are very, very pragmatic people. And even though sometimes you would wonder, you know, whether the state policy is enlightened, you know, whether it's actually going to achieve what the objectives are in terms of sort of, you know, one of the main objectives in terms of technology in China is autonomy. You know, in other words, that China would have greater control over the technology sector. Because I mentioned earlier on about issues of security and telecommunications, and particularly the fundamental objective in China, which is shared by the majority of the people, I would say, is that there is stability, political stability. And political stability in China means significant control over, you know, certain areas of particularly of political activity. So, you know, generally the model is that you can make as much money as you like, more or less, but you have to conform, if you like, to how the state wants to actually run the system, how it wants to ensure political stability and so on. So therefore, for example, you know, I mean, we have a very, very open system in the West, you know, where everything is discussed in a very, very open way. And we have sort of on the internet all sorts of, blogs and discussion groups and so on. But in China, there's much greater control over that area for the reasons, because of the nature of the system. That system is not going to change anytime soon. If anything, it's becoming much more controlled in recent times. The thing, as I said, the question is, you could ask yourself, I mean, do the Chinese policymakers, are they going forward in the right way? Some people will say that because of the level of control, of political control of the system, that this is preventing local innovation. But there is a determination among Chinese policymakers to try to raise the level of innovation. And one of the things I did notice, you know, in my earlier trips, was the emphasis on speaking about indigenous innovation in China. So in other words, that the state was becoming much more concerned about its dependence on foreign technology. And this is one of the themes that we explore a lot in the book. I would suggest one of the great topics internationally these days is that of innovation. Of course, we understand that innovation is the basis of rapid economic activity and so on. But the point is, I think a lot of the discussion about innovation, particularly in relation to China, I think maybe some of it is misplaced because we're not exactly clear what we're actually talking about in terms of innovation. And sometimes people will say that innovation in China is of a different nature. So because of the problems associated with that particular debate, I've tended to focus much more on trying to benchmark China's dependence on foreign technology. And I mentioned earlier on the example of the semiconductor sector, but there are other areas of dependence as well. And it's mainly a dependence on intellectual property. But the reality is that the design and the creation of new products and of new technologies and so on, even though China is making certain progress, particularly in the area of applying technologies, the fact is that it has a very poor record, really, of coming up with original designs, original products and so on. I'm not exactly sure how its ability to apply technology in a very, very innovative way in a very, very dynamic market in which non-Chinese companies find it almost impossible to compete. I'm not sure if that will help them, you know, to sort of eventually, through their investment in enormous investment in R&D and so on. But whether that will allow, and whether the political control in the economic system will allow for the necessary openness and creativity, you know, to allow real innovation.
Yeah, this is true. And your colleague, geographer Richard Florida, for example, might argue that China is not the perfect environment for creativity and innovation. But still, I insist, people that consider China place where creativity and innovation is completely lacking because of an authoritarian presence of the state, and where people are not able to invent and to develop new ideas are wrong, because still China in the past 20, 30 years has been a very creative environment. And what you said, for example, about the cashless society and artificial intelligence, facial recognition, mass facial recognition, in many, many high-tech sectors, China is now ahead. And this is not only this innovation, after all. But now I would like to make Sorry?
But I just had a small point there. In some of the interviews that I've been doing in the last few years, there are two things that are emerging. One is that some of the foreign companies in China that, you know, that say have significant control over key areas of technology and areas like chemical companies and so on, related companies, that they are very reluctant to collaborate with Chinese companies. And one of the reasons they're very reluctant to do that is because of the danger of losing intellectual property.
Yes.
And, you know, because there isn't, even though there is a very well-developed legal system now in China in terms of intellectual property, the application of that law is still quite weak. And so companies are very, very reluctant to trust their Chinese customers and sort of collaborators and so on. So the level of trust and collaboration is still quite weak between those who control the intellectual property and those who are dependent on it. And so there are sort of issues like that. You know, and it remains to be seen really how this is going to change. I mean, I do think that some of the policy is not as positive as it might be. I think some of the policy that is very focused on indigenous innovation is very, very, can be very influenced by a sort of a nationalistic approach to technology. I mean, obviously, the Chinese state have complete control over what happens within China. But again, just like the sort of what's happening in the advanced countries, where you know, they feel they're losing control over internationalization of economic activity. In the case of China, it sort of wants to almost put a boundary around its own country and to sort of create this sort of indigenous technology. In a world where technology is global, the nature of the technology is global. If you want to develop semiconductors as well, the most advanced semiconductors, this is a global activity. You can't it's almost impossible to do it within a nation state. So in some ways, even though they have different objectives, some of the political policy on both sides of the world is sort of a bit blindfolded.
Yeah, your book, by the way, is full of interesting figures. And to what you just said, we should add perhaps that currently the flow of foreign direct investment toward China and from China is the same. So we are now in a different stage of the story, where China going abroad is as powerful of the presence of foreign companies in China. Somebody might be scared of this, but it is happening now. And also, I would like to mention that, yes, you mentioned the Snowden case, and now there is the American Parliament busy with Facebook. So even in terms of freedom and the government, all private corporations infringing the regulation on data, also in the West, we have problems. And probably perhaps now, we can say that China was wise to let their own its own champions develop in this market. So having their own Twitter, their own Facebook, their own Google, before their market becoming colonized by the American giants, as instead happened in Europe, for example.
Well, actually, again, in some of the interviews I've done with technology companies in China, one thing that's very, very interesting is that in most cases, the people in the management of these companies are of Chinese background. They're either Chinese born, or in other cases, they are ethnic Chinese. You know, they may have grown up in America or something like that, and they've been spent many years in China. And this is very, very interesting, because in many cases, what I've noticed in the interviews is that they empathize very, very strongly with with China's objectives. That China is trying to rise as a nation. It's trying to do the best for its own people. It has huge challenges in many, many different areas, environmental challenges, demographic challenges, all sorts of different challenges, which are very, very problematic, really. And, you know, you're talking about one-fifth of the human population. So, but it is interesting that these managers who are trying to, obviously, you know, make as much profit in China as they possibly can on behalf of their multinational company, they empathize quite strongly with them. You know, the good objectives that China has. And in a certain sense, they actually have their tensions between their headquarters and how their headquarters see China, you know, looking at it from a distance. And very often they have great difficulty in trying to negotiate between the reality of China and how to do business in China. And that often means, of course, doing business in China often means, you know, having a certain closeness or networking with the government authorities and so on. And so there are very, very interesting tensions, you know, within these corporations in China because of the very, very different sort of cultural perspectives that you find from the headquarters as opposed to the people, the local people, who actually understand the culture better and who sort of appreciate, you know, what China is you know, quite rightly trying to achieve and so on. However, as I mentioned earlier on, I'm still questioning whether the Chinese policymakers are following the best, the most positive policies because, in order to try to achieve what they want to achieve. Because partly because they're not perhaps as sufficiently open to internationalization as they might be, you know, in the sense of they have to create the conditions whereby the owners of intellectual property are prepared to trust the local collaborators and to work with them and so on. Now, there is evidence of this happening maybe in some sectors like wind energy and the solar energy and so on. I think through the value chains that have been developed in China and through the, you know, the related supply chains, that there are more and more companies from outside China who are working with Chinese companies. That sort of contradicts what I said a few moments ago about the reluctance to collaborate. But there are, in some sectors, there's a greater willingness to collaborate, partly because China has become so dominant in, say, in some of the energy sectors. And over time, then, there is a greater transfer of technology, because basically what China needs more than anything else is a higher level of transfer of technology, of know-how from the companies that actually monopolize to some extent the technology. And this can only happen if you have a more, you know, a sort of a more understanding policy environment, which is not overly controlled, which is more open to negotiating some sort of a bargaining position whereby they understand they need the technology and they won't get it unless they trust.
Well, of course, there are so many challenges, and still your conclusions are rather optimist, perhaps, if I can say. In the very few lines, you say that there is a pressure against the globalization in the West, but this might produce negative outcomes for both sides, and the current anti-globalization reaction is not providing alternative solutions. But you also say that, for example, the Trump campaign rhetoric is more powerful than the actual policy. So what he's saying, what he's arguing, is actually much stronger than what he's doing in practice. And we also know that in the UK, many have changed. Sorry?
Well, I think one of the main reasons for optimism is that many of the young Chinese managers in China who are either running Chinese companies, particularly very innovative small technology companies, for example, in driverless cars, for example, new areas like that. And also the Chinese managers who are involved in multinationals as well. Many of these people, obviously, they're very, very clever people. And they're very, even though they know they are operating within a certain political system, and they may have certain criticisms of that, you know, they're aware of the limitations of that system and so on. But basically, these are people who appreciate the best technology globally. And they are very, very networked with Silicon Valley. And these are people who are, you know, they're traveling all the time, and they are sort of, you know, they are sort of exchanging ideas with the best people in the technology sector around the world. And this is the reason for optimism. So despite the fact that you have political constraints, not only within China, but also in, you know, in Washington and London as well, you know, people who are still, their thinking is to some extent still influenced by older models. However, having said that, you know, I think we should be aware that many of the Chinese leaders have, you know, significant educational input from the United States and from other parts of the world. Many of the top people in China are very, very aware of what's happening. But for political reasons, there is sort of two different dimensions, if you like, to what's going on China. On the one hand, you've got the top-down, you know, policy area, which is very, very pragmatic and it's always evolving. And then at another axis is the sort of connections between people involved in the real world of business and you know, nodes like Silicon Valley and other innovation centers. So my main reason for optimism would be that people will see, you know, what works best is, you know, what is produced by the most brightest people. There is a problem, however, in terms of the timing. It will take, I think, another 20 years maybe, 10 or 20 years before the balancing of ownership of intellectual property from the more advanced regions of the world, you know, to China, which will create then a much greater stability and a much greater level of trust, which will allow higher levels of collaboration.
Well, this is a very beautiful conclusion, almost a humanist conclusion. You say that people will probably find the solution before governments and before regulation and before businesses themselves. Here in Oxford, 2 months ago, there was Kai Fu Lee, and he's one of the examples of the people that you refer to. Probably is cosmopolitan, fully citizens of the world, and able to bring to China or bring to California what is the state of the art required for that specific business. So yes, let's hope, let's believe in those type of people. This was a very interesting conversation about a great book. Congratulations for writing it. I'm sure it will be very successful, in particular because it is so timely. This was China and Global Value Chain, published by Routledge just now in 2018. And the authors are Yu Tao Sun, and we just spoke with Professor Seamus Grimes from National University of Ireland in Galway. Thank you very much.